KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kboo.org or send to KBOO Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KBOO important? More information on the development director position is available at kboo.fm/developmenthire2018.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
People at 8 o'clock Hello. Know that they're gonna start late. We Hello. Should be good.
I can't hear. Hello.
Still no. I almost want to put my camera on the producer, but that would be a violation.
Okay.
Just like people see you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No. She's great. She's actually really dope. She even told me that I can send her a playlist in the hour before my show.
What would you play?
All 90s R&B.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and really nothing
yes.
else.
Yes. Oh man. Do you have a go to? Do you have one that like makes you like feel good?
Faith Evans.
See.
Yeah.
I think it's 2000. I don't think it's 90s, but there's that song like Just Friends. It goes do 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 do. No. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll play it for you. Maybe on here.
I know a song by Amy Winehouse called Just Friends.
Oh no. I mean, it's Amy Winehouse. Show you. What else was I listening to just recently? All Cried Out.
Oh, by Allure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-mm. Maybe I should just like tell her like come in here and
find. Is it?
Okay, she's coming in.
Okay.
Or maybe she's not.
Oh.
Somebody is.
You guys are on the air.
Can you?
You're on the air.
Okay, great.
Oh, awesome.
Okay. right now.
Oh my God.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, who is in the studio right now with Angelica Lim.
Hi.
From Gabriella. Mm-hmm. And the headphones don't work in the studio, but that's okay because we can hear each other and the people can hear us.
That was great.
And
I did karaoke.
This is good.
Shoot.
Working class practice.
I know.
I hope that you will pick up where I come up short here talking about Gabriella.
No, I mean, we'll have a conversation about it.
So the struggle against U.S. imperialism in the Philippines is primary in any and all of the good politics that are happening there. Yep. And the solidarity movements that are happening here and around the world.
Absolutely.
And I think what many people would be correct in identifying is that many movements for national liberation or against colonialism and imperialism have had a definitively patriarchal and male-led and male-centric character.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And the absence of feminism has been very apparent and has been a shortcoming in many people's estimation.
Sure.
So I see the importance of Gabriella as being not a beautiful side piece, but actually something at the center that's bringing a very crucial politic to the overall movement. And in Portland, what that looks like is having a militant force of young women and not young women, but mostly young women, and mostly young women of color who are very sharp in calling out U.S. aggression abroad. And that is not in as high supply as need be. So that there is a large and militant force of young women of color who are calling out U.S. imperialism, I think, is very important.
Yeah.
So I feel like I should start off the interview by saying thank you for helping to lead that force here.
God. Yeah, I think that, being here is an honor because we get to talk about this. And we, even just putting it on the air, like, when was the last time two, women of color were able to just talk about it? Yeah, just talk on it.
The listeners, I think, are lucky to be able to hear what you are about to drop. So as a preview, I'll tell people that what I want to talk about that I have on my list so far is Rodrigo Duterte, the president, who called himself a fascist.
Yep.
So we're
identified.
We're not accusing here. One of my trans sisters, Jennifer Lord.
Laude.
Oh, my God. Thank you.
No, you're good.
And the murder of her by U.S. troops.
Yeah.
And Maria Reza, who writes for Rappler, which is a critical news site that has some... critiques of Duterte and the attack against her that came out today where she's going to be investigated in the Philippines where she lives and works.
That sounds about right.
For tax evasion. So one more sort of strike against critical news sources that are already in short supply because of the authoritarian rule in the Philippines.
Yeah, the repression is really real there.
So that's where we're going, but I want to be able to let you say in your words a little bit about the origins of Gabriella, where it comes from.
So Gabriella actually comes from, it's an ode to one of our revolutionary mothers that never gets talked about, right? Mm-hmm. So in the Philippines is an archipelago, 7,107 islands, right? So we're talking about a diverse amount of peoples that had been colonized by both Spain, occupied by the United States, also had a brief stint with Japanese occupation. So during the like early Spanish colonization, 1500s, Diego Salong, who was one of the a revolutionary fighter, led a revolt against Spanish colonizers, died in the revolt. His wife took it up and led many successful revolts afterwards. And so Gabriela is named after her revolutionary fight and spirit, wow. Something that we don't talk about often, that many women and many non-binary folks, we call them the Babaylan in the Philippines, were leaders of, you know, revolutionary movements. And not in a romantic sense, the way in which we talk about, and the way in which some people talk about revolution here in the United States. We're talking about, you know, resistance and like an actual war to protect everything that is your home, right? Mm-hmm. So, Gabriela Salong.
Beautiful. Yeah. Salong.
Salong, yeah. And so that came about, and then there was, you know, to make it brief, but there was some underground organizing that happened, and it was called, there was an underground women's movement called Makibaka in the Philippines during martial law under Marcos. And then after that, I think it's what, 12, 13 years later, we've got Gabriela, who is now part of, we've got Gabriela Philippines, we have Gabriela in Amsterdam and the Netherlands, we have Gabriela in Europe, we have Gabriela wherever Filipinos migrate. So it's, you know, Filipino women advancing the militant Filipino movement as an extension, not in solidarity with the Philippines, but at an integral part. Oh. So I think there's a we have to distinguish that, because sometimes, you know, folks of the diaspora like to say, you know what, I'm in the United States. Mm-hmm. I can only be in solidarity with my mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. But if you are Filipino, or if you are about the Filipino, like Filipino liberation, mm-hmm. then you are part and partial.
Part of, not yeah. in solidarity
yeah.
with.
Yeah, you are
part of. It's an important distinction.
Movement. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Because I think that there's, you know, if you don't find yourself integral to a movement, then where, like.
Where are you?
Yeah. Yeah, and we can be in solidarity, and that's also a very particular role. But this is, like, we're integral to the liberation of our people in the Philippines.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. So before I go on to the next question, I just want to flag, because it's, like, a thing that I like to do. Let's not assume that everybody knows what non-binary is. So non-binary refers to a rejection of or not falling on either side of the gender binary, mm-hmm. Which would assert that there are only two sexes, two genders, and anything in between is a farce mm-hmm. and should probably be snuffed out, and we reject that outright. Non-binary people have always existed, and if I have anything to say about it, if we have anything yeah. to say about it, they always will.
Yep, absolutely.
And again, so that I can never forget, what is the name of non-binary people in
the Babaylan?
Babaylan.
Babaylan. Yeah.
Beautiful. Okay.
And they were known as also healers. So we have a very, like, the Philippines is a matriarch, like, first and foremost, before Spanish colonization. Mm. So, you know.
Let's get back to that.
Yeah. I mean, there, like, straight up. And so until 1500, we've also, like, the Philippines wasn't one formal identity as Filipino, right? The archipelago really distinguished different parts of the Philippines and different mm-hmm. islands. And so we're talking about, like, the effects or the affects of Spain and how they had to clump in everyone together,
yeah.
right? And then
and against their will.
Yeah. And yeah. then, I mean, and also you can see the impacts of Spanish colonization. That's an integration in the language. Tagalog is very heavily influenced by Spanish.
I hear it.
And then
also, I'm from Jersey City, New Jersey. Yeah. There's a lot of Filipinos there.
Oh, yeah. yeah. Trash is basura?
Basura.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
That's what we call it here today.
thank you.
And then also, like, another way you can see, I mean, we'll go into it, but, like, U.S. imperialism and the cultural side, we're talking about language, that English is now one of the main languages spoken on in the archipelago. It's a national language. But we're talking about when you say A is for apple, there are no apples in the Philippines. So, like, what kind of foolery?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Okay.
So, thank you for the background. Can you talk about your early work in Gabriella? Not yours specifically, but the early work of Gabriella. How did it get started? So we know the background, how it got its name, the legacy that it's hearkening to, but how did it get started?
I mean, Gabriella, we take heed from the leadership of Gabriella Philippines, which is addressing issues that impact women, LGBTQ folks, and their families. And so a lot of the issues that were impacting women, that's where you would see a pop of Gabriella. And so then we started to realize that there are not only Gabriella Philippines existed in the Philippines and we needed to build the movement there, but also the extension of migration, or what we like to call forced migration, not just any passive migration. Mm-hmm. Like, there's an economic force to it. So Gabriella USA started, and really like trying to figure out, where do Filipinas, not Filipino Americans, but Filipinos fit? So we're talking about migrant workers, we're talking about people who've been here first and second, third generation. How do we also continue to organize and make an impact here in the United States, where US imperialism does still currently impact the Philippines? Like, what is our role as folks not in the country? Mm-hmm. And so we started doing a lot of organizing there, starting to figure out the local issues of how Filipinos were affected. We're talking about trafficking, we're talking about impacts of what we like to call the three root problems in the Philippines. We're talking about US imperialism, bureaucrat capitalism, we're talking about feudalism, and like, how does that have an impact on our daily lives here in the United States, and how do we connect that back into the liberation of our people?
So what you talked about effects, can you say what kind of campaigns you've taken up that have been successful?
So right now, this is something that we're really continuing in the struggle with. Gabriella DC currently is waging a campaign. It's called Justice for Trafficked Teachers. A lot of our the trafficker, Isidro Rodriguez, who is also Filipino, had trafficked many Filipino teachers from the Philippines, all who didn't know each other, to Washington, D.C., took 20 grand from each of them, 20 grand U.S. dollars. So that's a lot of money. So that looks like impact on community, people really sponsoring their mothers to come to the Philippines, mothers and fathers. They were promised jobs in the United States. They were promised, and a lot of what happens is the forced migration is an impact on, there's not a lot of jobs in the Philippines, so a lot of people come here. About 4,000 Filipinos leave the Philippines every day. So these teachers were trafficked here, promised jobs in education, promised a salary. They got here and they all realized that they had one, maybe they didn't know they were trafficked, but they were not documented. Isidro took all their money and they were actually just in jobs that were, you know, being paid under minimum wage, under the table. They were able to provide for their family in the Philippines. And so what ended up happening is that all these Kababayan or our country people started getting together and started realizing they were trafficked by the same person. And so they created a Gabriella to hold Isidro accountable, to hold the Filipino government accountable, but also the U.S. government, right? Because we've got a couple key players in this. And so what is the protection of Filipino people who are trafficked? What kind of, what's happening in the Philippines that is creating the conditions, that are creating the conditions to traffic our own people, and like, and who's benefiting is always the question, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of Filipinos are actually trafficked to the United States not knowing that they're being trafficked, or they are, or it's looking like they're coming here and they're, you know, engineers, teachers, nurses, and they end up working as, you know, domestic care, like they offer domestic care, being exploited at their jobs, you know.
Mm-hmm. What happened to Isidro?
As he's on the run, I believe it's in Spain. That's the last we've heard of him. He's hopping everywhere. And so right now, some of the successes or victories of that campaign is that a lot of those teachers have actually received their T visas, which is great. But we're looking
for... Can you say what the T visa is?
It's just their... I believe it's their working visa. And so they're able to stay in the country and actually... you know, be
earn
able to
money.
Provide, yeah, earn money mm-hmm. and provide for their families. Mm-hmm. But now we still haven't been able to locate him. He's, you know, he's still on our radar. We're still trying to have the Filipino government also hold him accountable. But he's just hopping around Spain. The last time we heard he was in Spain was, I think, around a year ago. And so we don't actually know where he is. That one, I mean, he's like one, he's just a player in the larger game of, like, how we see, like, the Filipino government treating Filipino people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, briefly, or not, if you don't want it to be brief, mm-hmm. and to whatever degree you think is appropriate, can you talk about the U.S. government's role in this infraction?
Well, we're talking about just complacency, right? Complacency
okay.
and, mm-hmm. like, an inability to, like, well, we're also, it's the larger conversation around capitalism and imperialism and how we're taking advantage, or the U.S. government continues to take advantage of migrant workers coming into the United States and really exploiting work and labor.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of really complicit in that fact alone, not holding the Filipino government accountable also mm-hmm. for the negligence of finding out that Filipino workers are being abused in their homes and not being protected by their employers, right? Quotes, because I don't even know, you know, not being underpaid, being overworked, and then also not having any protections for Filipino people who've been trafficked. And what does that look like in terms of, like,
sounds more like a captor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And an employer.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay. So can you talk a little bit about the Portland Gabriela?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Portland Gabriela.
So how did Portland Gabriela get its start?
Ooh, it was actually a couple of things. Justice for Trafficked Teachers, that campaign really ignited, like, I was actually able to visit with or integrate with some of the trafficked teachers in Washington, D.C., and hear from their stories and the need to continue to build Gabriela chapters wherever Filipinos were. We had the former Gabriela USA chairperson, Valerie Francisco, who was also living here at the time, and we started having these conversations about what was happening with Filipino women in Portland. Were there even Filipino women in Portland? What is a Filipino woman? You know, these conversations of, like, one, diaspora, but two, what affects us? Like, and so we actually just started having really simple things like Filipino brunch. You know, brunch, whatever. It was popular, something broad to really...
Break bread.
Yeah, yeah. And we were having these conversations about who we were as Filipinas. A lot of us were second generation, and we started to realize that our stories were very similar, if not the same. Issues with mental health, issues with experiencing domestic violence, sexual assault, you know, issues around, like I mentioned earlier, one of the root problems in the Philippines, feudalism around religion and, like, our expectant roles as Filipino women. And so we were just having these conversations and starting to realize that, like, we had a lot in common, and we also had the power to really impact change. And then we started also studying Gabriela, the Constitution of Gabriela, and really trying to figure out how, like, these were our personal individual issues, and that's very valid and very important, and how does that connect to the current struggle that's happening in the Philippines, and that, like, understanding that it's connected to the three root problems in the Philippines is really something that, like, opened a lot of our eyes up, saying, you know, why are we here? Oh, our families were all, like, really indoctrinated to come over here, and that's not a knock to, like, our aunts or uncles or our parents. Like, mm-hmm. they came here and they made big sacrifices, mm-hmm. but our question is, why did they have to?
Sure.
Why do they have to when the Philippines is rich in natural resources? Why did, you know, it's abundant, mm-hmm. and yet...
It was good enough to be colonized and plundered.
Sure.
But somehow it's not good enough to live in.
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about lush, like, gold, zinc, copper. We're talking about an ability to really self-industrialize, really have, like, live off the land, a land that is supposed to be theirs but is actually being taken away by government, by, like, multinational corporations,
mm-hmm.
Dole, I can name on Dole. But so we were just connecting, we were finding out that, like, our individual issues, as important as they are connected to a larger economic structure that's happening in the Philippines. It's connected to an exploitation of our people, and it's, like, systematic, right? And so we wanted to raise the idea that, like, hey, we can build community, but we can also politicize that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, as it should be.
So what about the political situation in the Philippines? And you can go right to Duterte, or we can wait.
We can do whatever you want.
Well, I would like, so we know that there is a long, tragic, and shameful legacy of colonization.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And coming out of formal colonization,
mm-hmm.
now we have a democracy on paper.
Sure.
And yet there is inequality and violence abound.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that possible?
Oh.
Democracy is supposed to solve all your problems.
I mean, it's a trip too, right? And the Philippines really echoes its government like the United States. It's like a puppet government of the United States. A lot of the policies that are created in the Philippines are to mirror the benevolence, right? That echoing of benevolence of colonization, but also U.S. imperialism. A couple of things that we've been talking about most recently, right, is Duterte and the current investment, the U.S. investment in military aid in the Philippines. We're calling for an end to military aid. Currently, I believe the number is 180-ish, 84-ish million dollars is being invested in military aid to the Philippines to do training. But we're also talking about U.S. troops in the Philippines, but the question is, like, for what? What's the impact? What's the influence? And who? And like, and then we're also training the Philippine National Police. So the connection of militarization is a vast, it's a mirror to what's happening in the United States.
What impact has that had on ordinary Filipinos?
I mean, so I think this is a good segue to Jennifer Laude.
Sure, thank you.
There's currently the Visiting Forces Agreement that really protects U.S. military, gives them, like, almost absolves them from all responsibility of any impact that they have in the Philippines as you know. So I should go, like, historically. We have the red light districts, like in a lot of other countries too, red light districts that were created mainly for rest and relaxation for the occupation of, you know, U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
Even back further with Japanese occupation, we're talking about comfort women, women who were trained to be comfort, rest and relaxation for Japanese military. So we have a long history of, you know, and a trigger warning, but like rape and sexual violence being used on our community,
mm-hmm.
To really like have an impact and like actually, you know, have a culture of like this is how the U.S. occupies and this is how it's going to affect
domination.
Women. Yeah, domination and repression, exactly. So with Jennifer Laude in particular, so we have red light districts that are created. If you ever, which I hope you do, get to come with me to the Philippines and visit and see what's happening. We have a very particular perspective on prostitution in the Philippines because it is created for economic gain, like in terms of Filipino women leaving their homes to make money and make money in a way because there's no other way to make money.
Mm-hmm.
So Jennifer Laude, particularly, she and her friends were hanging out and she met, I forget his particular title, Joseph Scott Pemberton, I think he's a Navy man. And they met, and it's all, there's a lot of camera footage that tracks it, but they met and he ended up, and also a trigger warning too, he ended up choking her and putting her head in the toilet and he claimed trans panic.
As they do.
Direct evidence that he was in charge and responsible of the murder of Jennifer. And then what ended up happening after that was he was put back on the ship and protected. And then it was a very slow process on the Philippines end to actually try and hold Joseph accountable for his actions. He still hasn't been held accountable. And we're talking about not just like an individual claiming transplant, but we're also talking about like a whole government protecting their soldiers, mm-hmm. right? And saying that they can do whatever they want to our women yeah. and to our trans sisters, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, what a message.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about the job market, because the it's often said that, you know, like the biggest export from the Philippines is labor.
Yep.
So how is it that, again, a country that's so rich in resources mm-hmm. and is not short on intelligent people
nope.
that have skills,
absolutely,
but they have to go abroad to work? How is that?
It's intense. So there's a couple things that feed into that, right? We have a labor export policy during that, like, really actually, it was actually during my mom's, I like to go to my mom because she's an example of how the labor export policy impacted people in the Philippines. My mom tells a story all the time, and she talks about, you know, in grade school and in middle school, she always dreamt of being a nurse. And I asked her, was that your dream, or was that just a way to get out of the Philippines? And it turns out that she's like, most of us had dreams to be a nurse, or doctors, or accountants, because those were at the time of the labor export policy, and it's still being continued under Duterte's regime. It was a call from the United States and other areas and other countries to have more nurses, maybe because of war. And so my mom, alongside a lot of her schoolmates, became nurses at a very young age and left the Philippines. So we're talking, one, about a brain drain, that a lot of our skilled professionals are being exported to other countries under the guise of, like, you know, we can talk about, let's use our current situation, like the American dream, like, let's move to the United States and let's make a bunch of money, because poverty sucks,
sure,
right? And there are no good, you know, my mom talks about it all the time. If I were to stay in the Philippines, there wouldn't have been a good job for me. Like, to have that dream was kind of about being a nurse, but it was more about leaving poverty. And because currently the Philippines is not self-industrialized. Another part of it is that 75% of the Philippines is agricultural. And so we have a lot of peasants, a lot of farm workers who currently till the land but don't own their land. And so,
like a serf.
Yeah, exactly. We've got feudalism straight up mm-hmm. still, or actually pay to be on that land, you know, and are not actually reaping the benefits of it. So that's some of their, like, lifelong skill. That's what they were taught by their parents. And so some folks are having to leave their farmlands to go into the cities to find jobs that they don't have skills for, right? We're talking also about an education system that can be expensive too, that can be inaccessible to some. So education goes up to eighth grade, ninth grade, and so how are you supposed to survive if everything that you've known is your farm and living off the land, but that's not even your land to begin with, or it's being taken away from you by the government? We're talking about a deep, systematic rooting up of people whose skills are within the land, and they're not reaping any benefits, and if anything, they're starving. Mm-hmm. So we've got that kind of situation going on too. 75%, like I said earlier, is agricultural. So that's kind of skill happening as well. And then, so most of, like I said earlier, 4,000 Filipino people live every day mm-hmm. with those, like, with skilled labor.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're talking about another thing that happens is remittances. A large part of, like, the Philippines being able to actually have money coming back in is remittances. So people sending money back to the Philippines mm-hmm. for their families, and that's highly taxed.
It's a big part of the economy.
Absolutely. It's huge.
Yeah.
30% at least. And so it is a benefit for the Filipino government
to export
absolutely.
Their own people.
And then send money back home. Mm-hmm. Something that was really
because they get a cut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
With the teachers that I met in D.C., and it's not actually uncommon here, right? Filipinos move to the United States. They send a lot of money back home, and they're actually struggling here too. They're working 2 to 3 jobs, but they're also being able to provide for families, homes, going to college, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, but that cycle continues because then more people are going to college and then they're leaving the Philippines, being, you know, looking at the United States, Saudi Arabia, places in Europe, mm-hmm. to go and like leave.
So thank you for laying out what it looks like on the ground in terms of how people are suffering,
mm-hmm.
but how about how people are struggling and fighting back?
Oh my God, it's a beautiful movement.
Let's talk about it.
We have a beautiful movement. I mean, I think we've got Gabriella Portland here with Gabriella USA. We're really just, I mean, a lot of what our impact or what we're trying to do here is popularize what we've just been talking about, understanding the impacts of how the U.S. has an impact, has a responsibility to actually leave the Philippines and U.S. military aid. The movement in the Philippines is alive and well. We're talking about criticizing and really assessing Duterte's current presidency or lack thereof. His like something you've probably heard. It was a really really big on. I think it was a Times article. His war on drugs that Trump also has applauded. He's like applauded Duterte on like.
They seem to be friends.
I mean, buddies.
Or friendly.
Friendly.
Yeah.
Friendly. You know, which is interesting.
Mutual admiration.
Mutual admiration. And, you know, in the beginning of Duterte, I think even we were, like, he offered a lot of hope. He ran a campaign very similar to Obama. Mm. It was called, like, it was on hope.
Mm.
And he had a really high record. Like, I think it was 90%+ of the Filipino people were very excited for him to be there because he came from a part of the Philippines that was very pro-people. You know, he at the time sided with the, you know, with the New People's Army, like the revolutionary fighters. He understood that, the fight, the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
He understood about exploitation. But now we're talking about a war on drugs, which is actually a war on the poor. Extrajudicial killings of people who are assumed to be drug users, and he's, you know, a shoot to kill order that Duterte has said that he's trying to resolve the issues of the Philippines by killing drug users. And that is an attack on the poor. And we've also found out that like his son has an impact, or his son actually has some, like, is a drug dealer, and he is the godfather of many known drug dealers, drug lords. And so Duterte has a very particular, interesting mm-hmm. affect.
Mm-hmm.
Duterte is also, he's a mess. He's this macho fascist who just recently threatened, revolutionary fighters, women, who, and he said, you know, the only good purpose for them is, like, if I want to actually get rid of, like, siphon the revolutionary movement, I will shoot them in their private areas, in their genitals, right? So we're talking about somebody who's, like, you hear Trump on the, you know, I try to, like, figure out what he's trying to say, but Duterte, he's a hot mess.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a hot mess. We're talking also about
a lot of incoherence.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Okay. And so we're talking about a president that is about repression, that continues to silence activists, that continues to silence, like, I believe under his, there's been a lot of deaths of lawyers who've spoken up against him. There's been a lot of deaths of church leaders. He doesn't necessarily claim that he's the one participating in those murders, but mm-hmm. anyone who's ever spoken up against Duterte, there's a silencing that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a deep repression. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a silence of media, too. And so I think that he even uses the term fake news. Like,
mm-hmm.
he's bought into that as well. Mm-hmm. And so currently what we're saying is that Duterte is not the president for the people. He is not pro-people. Nothing mm-hmm. he's done has been pro-people. Even his war on drugs is not about the people. It's about some sort of macho fascist way of, like, rule. There's martial law in Mindanao. So we don't want him there. We're talking about an ousting of a president.
Mm-hmm.
The Filipino movement is does not want him as their president. Mm-hmm. And so...
So what does the fight against him right now look like?
Well, we're, like, all sectors are really coming together and organizing different parts of, like, all parts in kind of the city region and also in parts of the country. We also have he was also engaging in peace talks with the revolutionary government there for a while. He ceased peace talks. So, you know, at first he was saying it was a very promising thing that he wanted to engage in with the revolutionary government, but he has yet to continue those peace talks. And so we have different aspects of it, right? But for us in the United States, what we're hoping to do is really popularize what's happening in the Philippines and the impact of the United States that they have in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. So in the case that, you know, anything happens to the Filipino people from on the U.S. side, that we're able to really, like, call on our solidarity allies, call on Filipinos in the United States and say, hey, your tax dollars go to, like, military aid in the Philippines. We need to stop that. Mm-hmm. But we also need to, like, create conversation like akin to the Vietnam War. Like, what did it take to build the anti-war movement in the United States? What does it take to really popularize and understand that U.S. imperialism is not just in the Philippines, but everywhere else, and that we have a role? And so a lot of what we're trying to do now is spread some knowledge, but also organize around it, popularize what's happening there, because what's happening there is probably not very far from what's happening in other countries.
No, there's a race at the bottom. It's very interesting, and I hope you can tease this out. So,
oh my gosh, maybe.
Duterte is a strong man within the Philippines and is very happy to exert physical domination and violence mm-hmm. against the people there, mm-hmm. but has very little to say to global powers, especially the U.S.,
yeah.
and seems to be very much a lapdog
absolutely.
Of Trump. So I wonder if the potential for people to join the fight against Duterte here will be able to be more popularized because of how much of a buffoon he is.
Yeah.
It's like what I'm asking is, like, what can we expect from Gabriela in the future around this?
Well, I mean, so today is actually the birthday, and there's a connection here, but today, November 30th, is the birthday of Andres Bonifacio, which was also a revolutionary leader in the Philippines, and Anakbayan, which is, Anak means younger, like, baby. And so, but the youth movement has also called for an oust of Duterte. And so what we're going to expect here in the next year is more action happening all over the country. Gabriela's, Anakbayan's, Bayan Alliance, all getting together, and really trying to educate ourselves, other Filipinos, getting Filipino migrants on board, and talking about how the current situation in the Philippines is not too far from where we're at. We're talking about campaigns and coalition work, and really, like, when I talk about ending U.S. military aid to the Philippines, that's one step of that, right?
Yes.
Pulling the U.S. out of the Philippines mm-hmm. Is our goal, right?
To many people, that seems like an impossible
sure.
or a darn near impossible.
God, yeah. Sure.
While there does seem to be ostensibly a lack or a lessening of support for the U.S. military, it's not gone.
No.
And I'm not sure about successful movements.
Yeah.
That are able to raise the question of U.S. imperialism and the violence inherent in it, but I mean, do you have any perspectives about, like, any signs of hope how that can be done? Ideas for people?
We've done it before. I mean, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've done it before.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that we just need to do it again. I think that we have to take, like, I think we talk about it a lot too, like connecting. Like, liberation movements all over the world is kind of like where we have to start the education. That's how I see it, mm-hmm. is that understanding that the investment is in U.S. military, maybe the public opinion on U.S. military, you know, is lessening, but that's still our, like, that's still our dollar, right? Yeah. That's still, like, where, like, we still have an impact on that. So, like, the particular education of where your money is going and that you actually have an ability to say, that's not where I want my money to go. Mm-hmm. I want it to go into public services that impact my community. Mm-hmm. Like, that's one shift of that. I think I do have a lot of hope. I think it's going to have to create a, we have to have a creative struggle around it. We have to popularize talking about imperialism and U.S. occupation. I think we have to, we really have to get in there and talk to people about how it impacts them on their daily life. We have to do a lot more organizing on the ground. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what does that organizing on the ground look like now and look like in the future? Like, let's say your next campaign is optimal and you reach all of your goals that you mm-hmm. have set. Then what? What will that look like?
Are you talking about once the U.S. leaves?
No. I know that we'll have a more transitional process sure. to that. But yeah. I mean, locally, in terms of if Gabriella Portland, mm-hmm. which I absolutely want you to plug outright in a minute, but if Gabriella Portland reaches all of its immediate goals mm-hmm. in the short term, and then you're able to press forward with a campaign to engage more people and affect mm-hmm. some sort of change, what will that look like? What can we expect from an optimal Gabriella functioning at its highest capacity? Mm. Because we want to see it.
That's a good question. I don't know if we've
okay. Ever... We can come back.
No, I won't. Yeah, let's come back.
Okay.
I mean, what we can expect is, like, it would be, like, the optimal of running a campaign like that is that we would actually be able to... I don't know if this is an answer to your question, but, like, being able to be in, not every household, but, like, talk in institutions in different sectors, talking to women, or particularly women, organizing around building an anti-war movement. Yeah. Like, that... Another impact would be that other organizations of women would be created to understand, like, to have a class analysis, to have a class, like, understanding and class perspective. Like, that's something that would be optimal, is that we would inspire folks to actually organize around anti-war work and the anti-war struggle.
Fantastic. Okay.
That would be ideal. That would be, I mean, that's far, far from it.
Mm-hmm.
I think another thing that you can see is just growing numbers of people wanting to organize.
Yes.
And have conversations, growing numbers of our base, like really building an accessible anti-war movement, something that doesn't seem so far, like something that doesn't feel like strange or disconnected to the people, but like people who are suffering under police violence here in Portland. Like, ideally what it would look like is that if someone was talking about that, they're also connecting that to the larger, you know, like, global struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
excellent. I should say that I think one of the key pieces as to how this has been done before, and I mean a successful anti-war movement.
Yeah,
to be clear, when the anti-war movement, the movement against the attack on Vietnam, was at its peak, a lot of that had to do with the people in the military themselves that were refusing to continue to do the work of brutalizing people abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great documentary called Sir, No Sir that I suggest you and everyone listening to watch. It's about resistance within the military and what a crucial piece that was to broadening out and popularizing the anti-war movement.
Yeah.
Because from what I can see, one of the reasons that the anti-war movement, one of the reasons, there are many,
mm-hmm.
but one of the reasons that the anti-war movement or a anti-war movement hasn't been able to pick up and catch fire in the U.S. the way that we would hope is because of a sense of protecting us from the scary other, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, the war on terror is sure. meant to make you feel like our military is protecting you.
That's right.
And I don't think that's true. No. Many other people think that that's true, but not enough. Mm-hmm. And the other piece is this stuff around supporting our troops, yeah. right? The yellow ribbons.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So how can we acknowledge, one, that, and I hope we can do this successfully, the reason that people go into the military, which is essentially a poverty draft.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So the literal draft of mandating that people come in through a lottery mm-hmm. system is abolished, but for now is abolished.
Yeah.
But essentially, it's a poverty draft. If you're very yeah. poor, if you don't have prospects, if you don't have a lot of confidence, yeah. right? If you're lacking in options, then the military will welcome you in with open arms.
Yeah,
there doesn't seem to be very much of an emphasis at all about that analysis, even from the left.
Yeah,
that's popular enough, and I know that there are some efforts to do it. But then, even after they come back, there doesn't seem to be a push from veterans associations. And shout out to Veterans for Peace.
Yes,
But that orientation is not yet popular enough, and I hope that it can become more popular, because to me the best way to support your troops is, of course, number one, you know, you don't send them in the first place,
yeah.
but if they go, when they come back, you take care of them. And absolutely. That's not something that the U.S. does
it just discards veterans left and right. We're talking about, like, you know, really, like, houseless veterans. That's a very, very common problem. And so we're like, there's no care and concern. And so I think that's right, like, the organizing has to be, I think, like, that's like key and strategic, right? We're talking about people who've seen the impacts of war, feel that, like, have internalized the mental health, like, implications of being in war.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, firsthand on the ground experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now let's say that there are, you know, scores and hundreds of Filipina women listening right now.
Oh, yay. Hey.
Okay, they've never met you. They don't know you.
Okay.
Introduce yourself. Introduce Gabriella and recruit them now.
Oh, okay. Oh, hey. Hi. Let's go grab coffee or a beer. This is actually how I do a lot of my organizing, because
coffee
there's
coffee and beer?
Coffee. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, coffee mm-hmm. dates, because there's few and far, but like there's very few of us here. And so a lot of the people that I've met through Gabriella, we spot each other somewhere in public and I'm like, "Hey, how are you? Are you Filipina?" And I know that sometimes a taboo, but I think
it's okay when people of color do it to each other.
Yeah, or we're living in Portland.
Or less problematic.
It's less problematic. Yeah. I mean, maybe it is. I've been wrong many times.
Okay.
But I've also been right many times. And there's been these beautiful connections with Filipino women where I'm like, "Are you Filipina?" And they're like, "Oh my God, are you Filipina?" And we get into this conversation, and it's like, you know, it's a question, like, it's less about me introducing Gabriella, but more asking, how did they get here?
Mm-hmm.
How are they, like, what brought them to Oregon? That's got to be a really interesting story. If it's aunties, they talk to you forever. They just want to talk. And so a lot of it's just saying, "Hey, I'm part of Gabriella Portland. It's a Filipina women's organization that really is extending the National Democratic Movement in the Philippines. And mm-hmm. we're really taking up women's issues, things that impact women in the United States, but also women in the Philippines. And we really want to see, like, the ultimate, like, genuine liberation of our people. We want to see our people have choices and choose to be able to live in the country that has beautiful resources." You know, like, I go there fast, but it's real. Like, that's how we talk about Gabriella, is that, like, there is a current struggle happening in the Philippines, and we need to, like, it's quick. We have to really invite people to join us.
How do you feel about on the ground developments around resistance to Duterte now? Like, because I say that because it's very fast moving.
Yeah.
The war on drugs and just a background, the war on drugs in the Philippines, like Angelica said, is very similar to the war on drugs in the U.S., where the intention, if you're a cynic like me, the intention was never to actually lessen how many people mm-mm. are using drugs. Rather, the intention is to imprison and further marginalize people who are already poor
yeah.
and have no options.
Yeah.
So in the Philippines, it looks like something very similar. And this is what props up Duterte, because he feels like he's on a mission and he's able to assert that the war on drugs is righteous, even though it's so clearly bankrupt of any morality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I want people to have an idea of what the resistance against Duterte is like. You know, like people have an idea of what mm-hmm. the resistance against Trump is like, sure. where we might be able to wrap that up and explain it to someone who lives outside of the U.S. This is what the resistance against Trump looks like. Can you say what the resistance against Duterte looks like?
Are you talking about with Gabriela or just in general?
In general. Yeah. Like what are the conditions in the Philippines right now? The
resistance is rising. It is a viable resistance that during the State of the Nation address, 100,000 people came to the streets in the capital region and really, including church leaders, we're talking about people who are saying, this is not our president.
Fabulous.
We also have people in the countryside who are also organizing around, you know, and so that's another thing, the peasant movement. We're talking about farmers and workers who are also uniting on issues. All different sectors are really coming together and articulating how Duterte's policies are gravely negatively impacting them, and every sector of the movement in the Philippines is really like coming out. The women's sector, Gabriela, mm-hmm. the youth sector, talking about debt in colleges. We're talking about all these policies that are trickling down from the regime.
Mm-hmm.
We have every single sector really articulating how it is making people more poor. It is not Duterte is not serving the people like he said he would, and that he is. That his track record has been crap, mm-hmm. has been trash. Mm-hmm. And so it's building. It's building very, like, building heavily in the countryside and also in the cities.
Mm. I'm very, very interested in a movement to, or a campaign to end U.S. military aid. And I know that some people may bristle at that and say, why would you want to end the aid? The aid is there to help you.
Oh no.
So say why you say no.
What would be like the negative impacts of US military in the Philippines? There's no reason as to why they should be there. What, there's no service to the people.
So what happens to the money? So they send the money, they send the aid over. What happens?
And then training happens to the, like, the police.
Yes.
Yeah, right? So we're also...
This is where I wanted you to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, where are we going? we're talking about the investment and also hyper-militarization of armed forces of the Philippines.
Okay.
Squashing any kind of resistance. We're talking about hyper-militarization of our people. Not for the benefit, not for the protection of our people.
Yeah.
I was just looking at a statistic. I think it was... There have been 52 or 53 rape cases of Philippine National Police, right? And so, like, all of that is going, and they're getting away with it. We're talking about killings. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the impact. There's a direct impact.
That's where the money's going.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's getting fed.
No one's getting fed.
On U.S. military. That's what I think is so important for people to have a conception of is, you know, what they tell you they're doing with the money is not. The Philippines is rich in resources, food. It's mm-hmm. absolutely self-sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
There's no need for U.S. dollars to be there in terms of them being able to self-sustain. They can absolutely self-sustain. The issue is the presence of the U.S. in the first place.
And the occupation. And then also, like, the protection of, right, we're talking about multinational corporations. We're talking about, you know, what are they? They're protecting business. They're protecting conglomerates, the 1%. I think that that's another thing. Like, they are, like, U.S. military and PNP, they become protectors of the capitalists. I think it's also, I think my question would be for folks, like, where are they getting their information? Like, are we in an era where people are saying, yeah, like, where are we saying that the U.S. military is helping? Like, give me an example. Like, where are we hearing that?
Fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
So can you give some information about how people can get in touch with Gabriela?
GabriellaPortland.org. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, any kind of social media. We're there. Yeah, hit us up. We always want to do orientations with you about the organization. We're always out in the streets too.
Oh yes, I see. Oh yeah, yeah. I've made a choice not to have people on the show if they don't engage in protests.
Oh yeah, that's a good choice because you can do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So this is Angelica Lim, Gabriella Portland, and I will see you all next week on The Struggle. This is Alyssa, your friendly neighborhood agitator. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the